All right. Well, good morning. Hope you guys enjoyed the keynote. I guess we went a little bit long, so I don't know if I'll go a little bit shorter or we'll just take up some of your lunch. So you guys can give me some feedback as we go. So I'll just kind of gauge your response to the talk. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's new in Windows Azure. And actually, it should be what's new in the Windows Azure platform, because I don't want to just focus on Windows Azure proper. I also want to talk about SQL Azure, the Windows Azure App Fabric, and some of the other services that make up the platform. So some of what I'll go through will be similar to the keynote, but I'm going to try to take the time to go in a lot more depth. I'm hoping that because you're here, you've been using the Windows Azure platform. In fact, do you guys mind just raising hands? Who here has built some kind of an application that uses the Windows Azure platform? I'm hoping, a third of you. So a lot of you haven't used it. Is everyone largely familiar with Windows Azure, or was the keynote the first time? Who had not heard of Windows Azure platform before the keynote? One person, okay, good. Well, so what I'm going to do is really walk through these three things. And first thing I want to do is review some of the core services and concepts. And the reason I want to do this review is not only for people that are new to the platform, but also we've had this platform around for about 3 years now. So if you haven't looked at the platform for a year or maybe even less, there may be some core services that have either changed or that didn't exist before. So I want to walk through some of the core services. But then I also want to focus and spend more time on some of the enhancements that have taken place over the last 6 months, especially when we look at some of the enhancements that were announced and released around PDC last year. And then also as we go through this, I'm going to do a similar type demo, but when I walk through the demo, I want to spend more time really exploring what it is that's happening and what's going on. So I'm going to be flipping between presentation and demo more so that I can reinforce a lot of these concepts. And so you already saw this, the Windows Azure platform. And what we're trying to do with it is really build the most comprehensive and most comprehensive and best platform as a service. And when we talk about platform as a service, as I said before in the keynote, the way Scott Guthrie described it is really three core things. And first, it's the focus on your application and not the infrastructure. And that's very important with Windows Azure, because when you're using the Windows Azure platform, you just build the app, and then you hand the application off to us to run it for you. And so we'll walk into a little bit more depth in terms of what that means. Also, with platform as a service, it's important to think about elasticity and to be building applications that can easily scale within the cloud. And then the last thing is that the platform as a service model is a pay-as-you-go model. So that's kind of describing platform as a service. Here, what we're talking about is specific components to the Windows Azure. And the first is that it's open and flexible. And it truly is. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, Windows Azure can run just about anything that runs in Windows Server. Now, there's certainly some air quotes around that in the sense that you're building a highly elastic and scalable service, so there's going to be some differences as well. But for the most part, if it runs in Windows Server, it's probably going to run in Windows Azure as well. And that applies to applications as well as frameworks. We also want to talk about leveraging existing investments. And so this is not just applications that you've already built. So maybe you've built some MVC3 applications or ASP.NET applications, and you want to have them run in Windows Azure. But it also applies to the core skill sets and tools that you're used to today. So if it's Visual Studio, you still use Visual Studio to build a Windows Azure application. If you're used to using SQL Server Management Studio, you can still use SSMS for SQL Azure. And so there's a lot of corollaries, a lot of the similar tools that you leverage. And then the last part is the next generation application. And what I mean by the next generation application are different types of audiences and different types of platforms. So for instance, there's a lot of people building applications for Facebook, these social applications that in many cases have very little traffic for a period of time and then suddenly see huge spikes. And you want to ensure the success of your application is your ability to serve up some kind of content to your users. And so you need to be able to scale and to work with that type of spiky traffic. But then there's also mobile applications. And I'm going to show you guys that toolkit, because I'm pretty proud and excited about the Windows Azure toolkit for Windows Phone 7 and some of the assets that we've built that make it easier to build mobile applications using Windows Azure. And so we really think that Windows Azure is a great place for building out these next generation applications. Now, for those of you that are new or just kind of being refreshed, there are what I would say three core services to the platform. The first is compute. And again, compute just means this is where your application runs. When you build an ASP.NET application, you deploy it to Windows Azure, it's being run within our compute services. If you build a Ruby application and you package up the Ruby execution runtime and deploy it out into Windows Azure, that also is being run by the compute service. And so compute is where your application runs. Now, one of the things that's really nice about this platform as a service model is that not only can we run your application for you, but we can also do things such as automated service management. And what that means is that we can apply Windows updates to the VM for you and on your behalf, so you don't have to worry about patching the operating system. We can also recover from failures, whether it's a hardware failure or if your application crashes and brings the server down. We can monitor the health of that virtual machine and take action accordingly based on the type of event. And so that's one of the core values of having this platform as a service. Now, we also have a storage service, and we'll spend a lot more time looking at the storage service here. And essentially, the storage service is a highly scalable and elastic storage service. So if you think about building a highly scalable web application, if you didn't have a scalable place to store state or to store data, well, then the web application wouldn't be very scalable either. And so the storage service is scalable by default. And so what I mean by that is, if you look at our blob storage service, it's highly scalable in the sense of multiple copies of your data being stored and scaled across the data center so that it can serve it up extremely fast. And blobs are really good at serving up static data and media-rich data, so videos, images. I've even seen people take XML files and dump them in blob storage as well when they need an application to load up XML. So blob storage is a great place for that type of data. And then tables are really our NoSQL offering. And so what a table is it's highly partitioned data that you partition and you define the partition up front so that our storage service knows how to scale your data. If you think about, let's take an example of a kind of typical relational database model where you start off with a very simple application and a very simple, highly relational database backend. And what happens over the course of the app as more and more users start using it? Well, you take the relational database and you start making it maybe a little bit flatter. You remove some of the relationships between tables and you start duplicating some data so that you no longer have to join and you no longer have to have that relational engine being responsible for, you know, flattening out and making this data more available. And then before you know it, you've not only denormalized your databases, but then you start looking at ways of scaling out across multiple instances. So you start scaling and you create a cluster and you start clustering that data across multiple databases. And then once you've done that, you might look at now scaling up your infrastructure and putting more resources into the machines. And before you know it, what you start doing is start sharding and partitioning your data simply so that you can get more scale out of it. Well, at that point, you've now got partitioned and scaled data, and that's where Windows Azure Table Storage starts. So you start with highly partitioned data. And so Windows Azure Table Storage Service is great for that NoSQL, NoSQL type data. We also have queues. And what a queue is exactly what it sounds like. It's a place where you put data in and you take it out. So it supports very simple queuing semantics, enqueue, dequeue, peek, etc., delete. And so with queues, what you can start doing is segmenting the work so that you can start decoupling various resources within your system. So for instance, you may have a web application that accepts some information from a user. Maybe it's, you know, I want to calculate the value of this algorithm, or maybe I want to upload an image and have you create some copies of it. And so you can decouple your application so that the user input comes from one role, let's say a web role, and the actual work, the processing, the calculation is done by a separate role, a worker role. Well, how do you communicate between these two roles? Well, that's what a queue is used for. So you can use a queue to put a work item into the queue and start separating the processing responsibilities across multiple instances. And then the last thing here is drives. And I didn't talk about this before because drives is still in beta, but essentially what a drive is it's a way to mount our storage service as an NTFS partition on your machine. And the reason this is valuable is many of the applications that we've built and written use disk. So whether you're using system.io.filesystem or you use a third-party tool that may store some data on disk, the drive allows you to simulate an NTFS partition running in Windows Azure. And so these are the four different types of storage constructs available as part of the Windows Azure Storage Service. Now, the last thing is the database. And so SQL Azure is a relational database that's built on top of the SQL Server engine. And what that means is you benefit from not only having the SQL Server engine, but also from having the same programming model. So if you use table triggers or stored procedures or views or whatever it might be, whatever SQL object you use also will work within SQL Azure. The nice part about SQL Azure, though, is that it's a managed service. So you're not responsible for creating your database server or creating your databases or managing them or, you know, re-indexing or compressing or any of those things. It's done by us as part of it being a managed service. So these are the three core concepts. And so with this, what I want to do is this time I'm going to start from a file new project, and I'm going to walk a little bit slower through the application. And so I'm going to create a new project, and we'll create an MVC application. Let's see. Let's go ahead and just call this web. And I'm going to go ahead and use an internet application, and I'm going to also use the HTML5 semantic markup, just because it looks a lot nicer. I do like the rounded edges that you get with the HTML5. And so by default, this is a very simple application. We don't have our data model defined or anything like that. So I'm going to go ahead and quickly create the Northwind data model. And we're going to have, like before, a product and a category. Now, I think this is pretty neat because what I'm going to do is use the code-first model with the Entity Framework 4.1 to create my database in SQL Azure. And rather than typing all this again, I'm going to go ahead and use a snippet. And so here you can see this is a very simple picture of a product and a category. And you can see how here we define the relationships between the two. So on the category, we have a collection of products that are used by the category. And similarly, on the product, we have a category along with a category ID. And so the entity framework is able to parse this information within our object, and use it to generate our relational database. Now, some of the other nice things that I can do are I can add some attributes to it. So I can say, let's make this required, and it uses the system.componentModel data annotations. And I'm going to go ahead and add this. And what this will end up doing is when it generates that SQL to generate my database, it'll start marking things as required. So we'll go ahead and create that. Once it's built and it's created, now I can come here to my controllers. I'm going to go ahead and add a controller. We're going to create a product controller. And I'm going to use the product that I just created. And I'm going to create a new data context. And I'm going to call this the Northwind context. Go ahead and add this, and this creates all the scaffolding needed by the application to do the simple CRUD operations. So you can see it's creating these tables, creating all these guys right there for me. And I'm going to go ahead and also create a category controller. Select the category. And then I'm going to use the same, you know what I didn't do? I need to do a build. That way it actually will compile and build my Northwind context. So when I come back here and create my category, you can see now it specifies the data context as the Northwind context. So I had to do a quick build there. We'll select the category, and we'll go ahead and click Add. And so this will create the scaffolding there as well. Now, by default, if I just run this and hit F5, it's going to use SQL Express. So if you inspect and take a look at what the default settings are, it does use SQL Client and uses SQL Express. One of the things that Scott Hanselman has demonstrated, I believe at Mix, and maybe he's doing that even here, is you can very easily add a different database provider. You could use SQL CE, for instance, if you wanted to, and it would just overwrite the default so that it used SQL CE. What I want to do is use SQL Azure. And so what I'm going to do is go ahead and create a new connection string. And I've got that as a snippet here. And this connection string, the only real differences here are that we point to the SQL Azure endpoint. Now, the reason this works, the reason we can point to the SQL Azure endpoint is SQL Azure, at its base level, still uses the TDS protocol. So TDS stands for Tabular Data Stream, and that's what SQL Server uses under the covers to run. And so SQL Azure also uses TDS, and this endpoint is nothing more than a service endpoint that can accept and communicate across TDS. And so that's the reason why the only thing we need to change in our connection string is just the server. So instead of pointing it to a local server name or a local server instance, we point it to this endpoint. So you can see on the left here, it's set to TCP, so it communicates over TCP, so it uses NetTCP, and then it also is pointing to port 1433. Now, one thing that I see catching people a lot is when they start using SQL Azure, they'll try to connect to it, they'll use a connection string like this, and they just can't communicate to it. And that's because in many cases, that port is blocked outgoing. So if you try to run this and you see this type of behavior happening, it's most likely because your port is blocked. The next thing to consider is that within SQL Azure, by default, the firewall is locked down, meaning that when you first create a new database, a database server, there's no access to it out from outside. So you need to add firewall rules to your SQL Azure database server to allow access. In fact, let me go ahead and show you what that looks like. So if I come here to the portal and click on database, when I select my server, you'll see that I have firewall rules. Now, I've added a lot because I want to make sure that wherever I go, I'm able to demo and connect to things. So you can see what I've done is I've attached essentially IP address ranges to give access. The other thing that's important is even by default, we don't allow other Windows Azure services to communicate to the database. So you need to check this so that it includes the IP address ranges for existing services running in Windows Azure. So this is one of the things that we do to protect and keep the database secure, is using these firewall rules. All right, so I've added the database string. Right now, Entity Framework knows nothing about this database string. So what I need to do is go to that Northwind context that we created and tell it about the database. And so here, what I'm going to do is add that constructor. And so by convention, what this is saying is, when you create a new instance in the Northwind context, use that database name or that connection string name as the connection string that you use for the database. So it effectively says, don't use SQL Express, use that database instead. And so what's interesting here, let me go ahead and now note that that database does not exist because it's going to create a Northwind DB database. It's not there. What's kind of interesting is I'm going to create a breakpoint on the product controller, right here on the index. And go ahead and run this app. So it's going to load the app, hit the home controller. You see, at this point, the database does not exist. Even if I refresh, it still hasn't created the database. It'll only create the database the first time that you actually make a call out to it and then change it into a generic list. And the reason for this is the Entity Framework is what's responsible for taking the code and the object model that we've created and converting it into a SQL syntax that it can then apply and create in SQL Azure. So if I come now to our app and pull the product, you can see how we do this breakpoint. As soon as it ends up creating the database, I hope my internet's going to be better than it was in the keynote hall. All right, there we go. And return it. Now, once that operation is completed, if we come back here to the database server and refresh, now we should see our database exists because we've accessed the entity model once. It knows that it's code first, so it knows, it says, hey, that Northwind database doesn't exist. Let's go ahead and create it. So go ahead and return. All right, so in this case, we have no data, so let's go ahead and quickly seed this with some data. We'll do the same sort of thing. We'll add beverages and condiments. And then for product, let's go ahead and create a couple products real quick, and we'll remove that breakpoint. And since I already have the images up there, I'm going to go ahead and create the chai tea again. Bit of price, and then category. Now, the reason I'm doing this is I want to create some data. Now, the Database Manager is a great tool for interacting with SQL Azure, especially if you're a developer. And many developers I've found don't even have the SQL Server Management Studio tools installed. I know I always do, but if you don't have them installed and you want to interact with and query data and maybe create some objects and some data, you can use the Manager tool. So if I select the database and click Manage, this is going to pop me over to the Database Manager. And after I log in, what I can do is it gives me very much the same types of capabilities that the SQL Server Management Studio does. And it has a spinning cube that is sure to delight your friends. So you can spin this cube around. What's actually kind of cool here is it tells me exactly how much of my database I've used. So right now I'm using the web edition of the database. I've got 1 gigabyte, and I'm not 1 gigabyte available, and I'm not using very much. But I can go ahead and I can take a look at this data. I can go ahead and query it, look at the schema, and basically do a lot of the various operations here that you've done in SQL Server Management Studio, so SSMS. So that's nice. Definitely something that I think once you start looking at it, you're going to take a lot of, or you're going to use it a lot. Great. So we've got this. Now, in this case, I mean, pretty simply, and I hope you think that it's simple. I mean, it didn't take very much, but I'm now using a SQL Azure database within my application. So that's one of the very first things. So we're using one of the three core services. The next thing I want to do is leverage Windows Azure Storage. So let me show you in the portal exactly what this looks like. So if I come here to the hosted services, storage accounts, and CDN, and look at my storage service, essentially what we have is a concept of a storage account. And when you create a storage account, you can see here I've got 5 storage accounts created. It's in this storage account where you can then define other types of entities like containers and blobs and so forth. And so at the very top level, you've got a storage account. And within storage accounts, you can create containers. And within containers, you can add data. Now, from this tool here, from this portal, it doesn't really give you that type of look on top of your data. So one tool you may want to use is Cloud Explorer. This is a free tool by Clumsy Leaf. There's a lot of different storage explorer tools out there. I happen to like this one. And what it does is it gives you a way to kind of nicely and hierarchically look at your data. So for instance, here I have one container, and it's got some images in it. Now what's interesting about the container is at the container level, you can apply policies. So in this case, I've got images that I want to make available for everyone to view. So obviously, I want to have public access to it. So if you take a look right here, we can see that I have a policy defined that defines the type of access control that's available for this container. So for instance, here, it's set now to full public read access. I could make this private. And when I make it private, what that means is if I just try to browse directly to a resource in this container, it's not going to be available. In order to interact with a private container, what we need to do is pass on a request header that has an authorization string that's read by the storage service and grants us access. So you can use what's called an account name and an account access control an access token to define this header that embeds a resource that allows access to our storage service. So what I can do here, for instance, is I'll go ahead and create a new container. And by default, these will be secure. And if I, let's say, I think I should be able to copy this in the tool and put it right in here. Let's see. All right, so I've moved that image into the secure container. If I go ahead and take a look at the properties, what I'll do is I'll copy this URL, open this up, and I don't have access to it. And that's because this is private. So now there's 2 ways that I can grant access to this resource to a user. One is I could use the storage access key along with the storage name, and in the application, in the client that I'm building, create this request header. Now, the problem with that is it means that I have to give my key to someone else, and that's not necessarily the most secure thing. So if I'm embedding my key into an application I build that I give to someone else, well, that key is not going to stay private and secure very long. Someone can very easily, you know, reverse engineer the application and figure out what this key is, and suddenly now I don't have a secure storage location whatsoever. Another thing that we can do is generate what's called a shared access signature. And a shared access signature is a short-term, time-based policy that grants access to a resource to an individual. And so you can certainly do this programmatically. I mean, there's APIs. This entire tool right here is doing nothing but hitting the storage service APIs. But it's a nice, easy way to demonstrate how this stuff works. So what I can do is right-click the resource. And I'm going to go ahead and right-click the container. And I'm going to create a signature policy. And what this means is it's going to use a policy that is going to be valid until 12:44:50. It's going to be valid until 12:44:50. So basically, well, it looks like that probably has already elapsed. Let me go ahead and close and do that again. Let's make this a little bit longer. So I'm going to create this policy. And essentially here, let me go ahead and copy what the signature looks like. Oh, I didn't copy it. Let's try that one more time. All right, copy, okay. Oh, it's not doing the copy function here nicely. Well, here, let me just try to show it to you here. Essentially what it is, there we go. You can see here, here's the storage account name as you'd expect, mvc3demo.blob.core.windows.net/secure, the resource name, but you can see all the additional information that it's attaching here. And essentially what this metadata is it's defining a policy that when the storage service sees this additional metadata as part of the query string, will grant access to the resource for a short period of time. And so this is one way in which you can generate a secured signature that's defined by a policy and give access to a resource to an individual for a period of time. And so you can do this programmatically. You can do this a number of different ways, and it's a great way to give access to a resource for a period of time. Apologies that for whatever reason I can't copy it. I don't want to try to type that out by hand. I'd never get it correct. All right. So coming back to the application, what I want to do is let's just grab these public URLs again. Go ahead and grab them and edit this. You saw some of this before in the keynote. Go ahead and save that. Oops. I changed the wrong thing. And now I'm going to just quickly represent this data in a little bit nicer format. So we'll come here to our products index page, and we'll just essentially wrap that so that we can actually see it as an image. All right. So we're serving this data up now directly from blob storage when we refresh. Now, I showed before as well the CDN, and I want to spend a little bit more time talking about the CDN because it's a great service. In fact, let me jump back here because I think I have some more information first. All right. So those are the core services. Some additional information, because one thing that I think helps after having seen some of those core services is understanding where we've come from, because there's been quite a few changes over the last few years to the platform. The Windows Azure platform was announced in October of 2008, where we launched some of the services, specifically compute, storage, and the Windows Azure App Fabric. And so we launched this as a CTP service, which was basically open for people to use. When we first launched, however, SQL Azure didn't exist in the form that it does today. It was originally called SQL Data Services, and it was essentially a NoSQL database for structured data. And one of the things that we discovered when we launched this was we got a lot of feedback from you, from other people as well, saying that having two storage services, both Windows Azure Table Storage as well as the SQL Data Services, didn't make a lot of sense. And what people really wanted was a relational database that was available as a managed service. And so in March of 2009 at Mix, I think this was Mix 09, we announced that SQL Data Services was moving into SQL Azure, which was a fully relational database. Since then, we had some other updates. So in November of 2009, we made a number of updates. First of all, with Windows Azure Compute, when we first launched, we only allowed applications to run in medium trust. And what that means is in medium trust, there's a lot of things you can't do. For instance, you can't run a PHP application in medium trust because in medium trust, you can't use fast CGI with IIS. And so in November of 2009, we opened up full trust to the platform, which allowed us to do a lot of additional things, such as running PHP applications. It even allowed us to now run native code within Windows Azure. So that was a big update to the platform. We also announced some services that we would eventually release as well, such as the VM role, which is the virtual machine role, along with Project Sydney, which was a code name, which is now called Windows Azure Connect. And other things, particularly the pricing and the SLAs of the platform. The other service that we announced was called Project Dallas. That has since been called Windows Azure Data Market, and it's essentially a data market service where you can consume data sets as part of your application. Then in February of 2009 is when we went into production, when it was generally available. So if you think about it, I find it at least a little bit kind of amazing that in terms of a production service and a production platform, Windows Azure has been in production for just a little over a year now. And it feels like we've come a real long way. And then in June of 2010, we had some additional updates to the platform where you started to support the .NET 4.0 framework. We allowed you to version or choose a different version of the OS. It's where we announced the CDN. And then we also provided some important updates to the SQL Azure environment as well, such as larger database sizes, the support for additional data types such as spatial data. And then we also started to support data-tiered applications. How many of you are familiar with data-tier applications within SQL Server, SQL Azure? Okay. Well, a data tier application, which is also called a DAC, gives you a way to define your database model and deploy it as a package and as a unit. So you may be familiar with packaging up your applications via things like web deploy for web applications. And what a DAC does is it allows you to package up your database and deploy it as a unit as well. And so adding that support to SQL Azure is pretty powerful because it makes it a lot easier to take the database that you've been developing and building locally and deploy it out to SQL Azure. Now, the big updates to the platform came at PDC last year in November, or shortly after PDC in November. The first thing that we did is we updated the Windows Azure portal. So you've seen it because I demoed it, but it is now a Silverlight-based portal, whereas before it was HTML. And we've given a lot more granularity and a lot more control to you to interact with the services that are deployed. So that's been one of the important updates. We also gave you the ability to have multiple service administrators on your service. So for instance, imagine being a developer and having access to an environment and you being the only person that has access to deploy or manage the environment. No one else can unless they have your same live ID. This was kind of a difficult thing, I think, for a lot of development companies and shops. Meant that a lot of people were sharing the same live ID account. And with this update in November, we supported the ability to have multiple administrators or co-administrators within your service. Also, we announced support for remote desktop. Now, remote desktop is a very interesting service because in many ways, the concept of having a platform as a service means that you don't want necessarily to have to remote in and interact with your operating system, right? But what we found is that many cases, it's hard to debug when things don't work the way that you expect. So I build my application, everything works perfectly locally, I deploy it out to Windows Azure and suddenly it doesn't work. Well, by enabling something like remote desktop, it gives us the ability to remote into the environment and actually see exactly what's happening. You know, is it that it doesn't have access to a particular setting in an IIS? Is it not configured correctly? Or some other setting. So remote desktop is a great development tool for debugging and figuring out what's happening in the application. Now, what I think is probably the most significant update was the support of what we call full IIS. And that may sound kind of funny because, you know, didn't we support IIS before? Well, it turns out until this update, what was actually running in Windows Azure was called Hosted Web Core. Now, Hosted Web Core in many ways looks like and feels like IIS, but it is not the full IIS 7.0 or 7.5. And consequently, many of the things that you can do within IIS were not supported within Windows Azure. For instance, if you wanted to leverage smooth streaming, you know, IIS does a great job in supporting smooth streaming with video files and making it very easy for you to progressively push video content to an end user. Well, in hosted web core, you didn't have the ability to add something like smooth streaming. And so by moving to a model where we're leveraging the full IIS gives us a lot of more flexibility in terms of the types of applications we can build. You can do a lot of different things in this context, including one of the more important updates is the ability to host multiple websites within one set of role instances. So with hosted web core, you can only run one site. With full IIS, through the service model and defining your application, you can specify more than one site to run within IIS, which makes a very cost-effective way to bundle your applications into one set of role instances. So full IIS is a very important feature that we added. We also added support for Windows Server 2008 R2, not just Windows Server 2008 SP1, which means that you can now use IIS 7.5 in Windows Azure. Now, Windows Azure Connect was introduced as a CTP, and what Windows Azure Connect does is it gives you the ability to establish a low-level IPsec network connection with your resources running out in Windows Azure. So if I have an application that's running in Windows Azure and I want to interact with resources that run locally in my environment, I can use Windows Azure Connect to create that IPsec relationship and then have my application in Windows Azure talk to my local resources as if they're on the same network. So I've seen a lot of customers use this for running a web application in Windows Azure that's communicating with a local SQL Server database that, for one reason or another, they can't or don't want to deploy up into the cloud. Sometimes this may be because of, you know, it could have sensitive personal information. And so Windows Azure Connect allows for a lot of these different scenarios to be supported. We also announced support for the Windows Azure Virtual Machine role, and so this came into being as a beta. Now, what the virtual machine role allows you to do is create your own copy of Windows Server, so it's a VHD, set it up locally, you use Hyper-V, you create this role instance. Once you've got everything installed on the machine the way you want it, you will do a sysprep generalize. And what that means is it's going to remove any of the device drivers, any of the things specific to running that image locally on your machine. So you'll sysprep generalize that VHD, and then you can take that VHD and deploy it to Windows Azure. Once it's been deployed to Windows Azure, you can then create a new role instance that's using your VHD as the base image. And so what's nice about this is you can pre-install all of the software and services that you need or want for your application onto the image rather than having to add it after the fact and add it to the existing existing images that we provide. And so this is a nice way to take existing applications that you have that may have a lot of things that they're dependent on in the operating system, set up that VM role, and then run your application in it. Now, one thing I do want to mention and caveat is that this is not infrastructure as a service. Once you create the VHD and deploy it into Windows Azure, we run it just the same way as we run a web role or a worker role. And what that means is that if the machine gets restarted, if it fails, if we have to scale it up or scale it down, we do not preserve the state within that operating system. So if we restart it or move it, it's going to start over from scratch, however you left it when you generalized that instance. So a lot of people say, well, can't I just install SharePoint and SQL Server in a VM role and deploy it out into Windows Azure? Well, sure, you can. You can do that. But the first time it gets restarted or reset, anything that's changed in that operating system will be gone. So with the VM role, you still need to be cautious. It's a great way to have all the software you want already installed on the image, but it doesn't mean that you can run an application in Windows Azure without having it set up to handle the fact that that state of the OS is not preserved. All right, and then the last thing was just support for extra small instances, which is basically just a cheaper role instance option for you within the platform. Essentially, it's a little bit less resources for a lot less cost. I mentioned a lot of this already about full IIS, enabling a lot of these new scenarios like multiple websites. You can also configure multiple virtual directories underneath them, configure any of the IIS extensions that you want. For instance, one of them that I like to use a lot is application warmup, so that the first user to hit the site doesn't pay that JIT compilation tax. And so you can kind of warm up all your stuff. And then it also enables things like web deploy. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we released an update to the Windows Azure 1.4 SDK with web deploy tooling built into Windows Azure for within Visual Studio. So what's nice about web deploy is that I can build my application, right-click, and say publish, and it'll publish it to my running instance so that any updates I make are instantly available in that running instance. The downside is that what I've just done is I've updated a running instance. If that running instance resets, guess what it's going to get? It's not going to get the update that I deployed via web deploy. It's going to use whatever the base package was that I deployed to Windows Azure. So web deploy is great for development scenarios where you don't want to have to wait 8 to 12 minutes to deploy and see what an update looks like, but you just want to deploy that application very quickly. Web deploy is not meant to be used for a production instance because anything you deploy will not be stored durably. Now, something that's also kind of interesting with these updates was this concept of a startup task. And what we did with startup tasks is within the model that defines your service package, you can create this element called startup and in there specify a task. And what happens is when this gets packaged and deployed into Windows Azure, before the load balancer allows traffic to come to your instances and before your instances are marked in a ready state, it's going to execute this script. So in this case, you can see the command line is pointing to a script called install mvc.cmd. So as it's installing my application in the role instance, it's going to bootstrap that role instance by running this command. It's run in an elevated context so that it's run as an administrator and it has the access to install things. And then you can define some types of tasks. So by default, it runs as simple, which means that, hey, it's not going to mark that instance as ready until the script stops running. But you can also run it as a background task. And the reason a background task is nice is when it's running the script, it allows traffic through the load balancer so that I can remote into the instance. And this makes it very handy for doing RDP into the instance and debugging any problems, because sometimes these scripts may not run as you'd expect within Windows Azure. And if the load balancer doesn't let you get to the instance, you can't debug what went wrong. So by running something as a background task, you have the ability to see what's going on. And so what I'm going to do is show you one way to prep this machine to run in Windows Azure. Now, right now, I think I'm still running. Let me go ahead and close that. Right now, I've just got the MVC application. And in the keynote, I showed one technique of essentially adding all the references for MVC as copy local true so that when we deploy the application, everything we need to run the MVC application is there and ready. There's another tactic that we can take as well, and that's using startup tasks to bootstrap the instance with MVC. So first, let me go ahead and create my... it looks like I didn't create my Windows Azure project, so I'm going to quickly create that. And I'm not going to add a web role to it. I'm going to use the web app that's here. Go ahead and click Add Web Role. Select this one. And I'm going to do something similar to the keynote in the sense that I'm going to grab a NuGet package, but instead of grabbing the NuGet package that's specific to MVC3, I'm just going to grab a very generic one. So if we search for Windows Azure, there is a Windows Azure Web Role NuGet package right here. And all this will do is install just the basic assemblies and classes needed in order to run your application as a web role. So let me show you what it installed. First, it installed three assemblies. The Windows Azure Diagnostics, so this is a way for us to collect diagnostic information across all of our different role instances. It added the service runtime, which effectively gives me a way to have an entry point for Windows Azure to call into my application. And then a storage client library. And the storage client library is essentially a .NET library that wraps all the REST API calls to the storage service. So we don't expect that people will want to be, you know, writing all their own libraries to interact with the REST service and do the Base64 encoding in order to access storage and things like that. So we've provided a storage client library to wrap all the storage services. So it adds these assemblies. And what it also does is it creates this web role class. Now, what's nice about the web role class is I mentioned that there's a hook into my instance. And essentially, what happens is you see that there's a role entry point. And this role entry point effectively is a way for Windows Azure to call into my application and start and manage a service. So you can see when it calls this web role, what it's going to do is first on start, it just runs the default base on start, but then it'll do this run command. And what the run command effectively is it's just an application that's going to continue running in the background on a different thread that's managed and watched by Windows Azure. So you can do a lot of background operations. You can effectively use this as a worker role if you want, but running within your web application. So the NuGet package creates all of this. What this NuGet package did not do, though, is add the MVC stuff. So what I want to do is create a startup task to do this for me. Now, I like to use the convention of creating a new folder called startup. And in startup is where I'm going to put all of these different resources. And so let me make sure I have this. So I think here I've got, I'll just move this here. What I've got are a couple of items. I've got the ASP.NET MVC3 setup MSI file. So this is essentially the file that you can run to install MVC3 on your machine. And then I've also got a command in that install MVC command that I'm going to call into. So what I'm going to do is add those items to my application. I'm going to add them. And now, by default, when I add these, you can see here that these are not specified to copy to the output folder. And that's a problem because if they're not specified to copy to the output folder, Windows Azure will not add it to the package that is used to deploy your application. So for any of these resources that we add, we want to make sure that we set copy output to always. So that way it's going to add it as part of the package that's created. Now I now need to, well let's actually, real quick, let me show you this command. It's very simple. Essentially what I'm doing is I'm invoking from the command line in that percentage tilde dp0 effectively just is the bin directory that I'm running my application from. So that just invokes this command from the bin directory, and it's going to call ASP.NET MVC3 setup. Note the slash q. That's important because if you think about it, this is an unattended installation. If I don't put the slash q indicating that I want it to run as quiet, then it's going to pop up a dialog box and wait for user interaction. And if I'm deploying this to 100 instances, there's no one there to click OK. So you want to make sure that your scripts are always doing silent installs for things that you're installing. And then I also, the last thing I do is log it. And the reason I log it is if there is a problem, I want to be able to remote into this machine and look at the log to see why didn't it install? What was wrong? And so I always try to log the information out to a resource. And then the last thing I do is this exit B/0. Tomorrow in my best practices talk, I'm going to get into this a little bit more. But effectively what this is doing is it's doing a graceful exit out of the startup script. And that's because think about if something fails in the startup script, you don't want your role instance to be marked as ready because you haven't successfully installed some of the software needed to run your application. So if something fails and it doesn't do this graceful exit, then the Fabric controller, which is managing and monitoring your application, will not move your application into a ready state. It'll keep it as busy or it'll try to restart it. So it's important in your startup tasks to do this exit /B0 to gracefully exit out of your startup task. And that's all it is. And so now what we need to do is update our service model to effectively call out to the service. So here's the service model. The service model is what's used to define how your application is configured and how you want it to run. And so underneath my web role, I'm going to go ahead and add startup. And I'm going to add a task. And now in the task, what we're going to do is specify the command line, and it's going to be startup / install mvc.cmd. I can specify the execution context. By default, it's elevated, but I like to be explicit. And then also, there's a task type. This is what I was mentioning before. By default, the task type is simple. And really, if you're doing a production app, you want to keep it at simple, because simple means that you're not going to move your instance into a ready state until the startup task is successfully completed. For debugging, though, it's nice to use background. Now, foreground is something that you really probably shouldn't use at all. We really only use foreground. In fact, I question whether or not we should raise this up through the tooling. Foreground is not really meant for us as developers. It's used by the platform for things like RDP and enabling some of the other capabilities within the platform. So Foreground really isn't meant to be used. I wish we'd take it out. But you can make that background. And that's it. So what we've done effectively here is provided an instruction to Windows Azure that says, hey, when you're installing and running my application, bootstrap it by running this command line. So I'll show this deploying in a moment. I'm now going to comment this out, because as I run this locally, I don't want to continually reinstall MVC3. So I'm going to just comment that out here. And that's effectively a startup task. You can use startup tasks for a lot of things. In fact, let me see if I have... Good. Okay, so here I've got another solution. I'm not going to spend a lot of time walking through this, but what this... that's fine. I just won't run it. What this application does, and I have a long blog post describing how it works, is it's using Windows Azure to encode video using the Expression Encoder tools. And what's interesting about this is I use a worker role to install or to run this encoding service, but I use startup tasks to prep the machine to include the Expression Encoder tools. So let me show you this startup task, because it's an interesting one. Oops, not that guy. And all right. So the very first thing that's needed, I mean, think about the fact that these role images are Windows Server, right? So by default, Windows Server doesn't have the desktop experience enabled, which means that it doesn't have access to media codecs or media players or anything like that. So in order to even install Expression Encoder into these instances, the very first thing we need to do is set up the desktop experience. So you can see here, what I'm doing is I'm running Server Manager CMD, which is just a base, it's a command within Windows Server, and I'm saying install the desktop experience, restart the machine, and then send the results to this XML file. Now what's interesting here is the very first, when this completes successfully, what it's going to do is it's going to restart my role instance. And so Windows Server is going to restart, and it's going to reboot. And we need to do this because the desktop experience will not successfully complete the installation until this restart. So what this is also saying is that our startup tasks need to be idempotent. And what I mean by idempotent is that they need to be able to be run multiple times without causing problems. Because once this machine restarts, it's going to run this startup script again, and it's going to call Server Manager CMD. And fortunately, Server Manager CMD exits gracefully and fine when run a second time if something's already installed. And so then it's just going to move down the lines, move down the stack. So the next thing that it's going to run is it's going to create this directory called basically tilde dp0 or percentage tilde dp0, which again is our bin directory, our execution path, and it's going to create an app data folder. And the reason we do this is we need to run this registry key and change the user app folder. Now, this is an interesting problem, because the reason we have to do this is in Expression Encoder, the installer is 32-bit, but Windows Server is running as a 64-bit operating system, and so it causes a problem. When you try to install Expression Encoder into this environment, what happens is it tries to write some temporary files to a location that doesn't exist, and so it gets confused. And so we run this operation and update the registry so that it knows where to put these temporary files before we actually call the installation right here. And when we install it, what we're doing is we're leveraging the web platform installer, but via command line, because again, we want to do a silent install of the product. So we automatically accept the EULA, we tell it to install Expression Encoder, and we log it out to a file. And then eventually, when we're all done, we exit gracefully. And so this is just another example of a little bit more complex of a startup task that you can use to prep and prime your machine with software that isn't there by default. All right, so hopefully I've kind of gone through startup tasks in enough detail. We'll move on. So the Windows Azure CDN. It's enabled from the portal. It's really nothing more than a couple of check marks and clicking an OK button. And what's nice about the CDN is that it's fully integrated with the Windows Azure Storage Service, meaning that anything you have stored within a blob and within containers in a blob can be added to the Windows Azure CDN. Now, some enhancements that were recently announced and made available are listed out here. First is now you can not only serve up data from the storage service, but you can also serve up some of your static data that's stored within your web application. So if you think about many of our applications, we have a lot of static resources such as style sheets. Sometimes we keep images within the web application. We may have scripts. A lot of these things that are static and that you don't necessarily want users to have to download over and over and over again. So through a convention with the Windows Azure CDN, you can tell it to start caching some of the resources that exist as part of your web role. So that's a pretty handy feature, that an enhancement that came recently. What we also announced was the ability to support HTTPS so that you could still have an SSL connection when you're connecting to the CDN if you want to make sure that those resources remain secure over the wire. What's really nice about the HTTPS support, though, is that cross-scripting thing, right? So if any of you have built an application and your application is, you know, running securely HTTPS, and then you try to load an image from HTTP and Internet Explorer pops up a warning message saying, hey, you're trying to load a non-secure resource in a secure website. Well, with HTTPS support, you can turn that on and you won't get those messages any longer. And then the last thing, hopefully you can see at the bottom here, sorry about that, doesn't look like it's fit well, is we announced that pretty soon, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, we're going to launch a CTP support of smooth streaming within the CDN. So what that means is that you'll be able to take media content, put it in the CDN, and then leverage the smooth streaming support for your end users right from the CDN. So not only does that full media file get cached closer to the end user, but they also can progressively download it. All right. I'm actually not going to demonstrate this. Like I said, the CDN is something that's pretty quick and easy to enable. And also, since the keynotes went so long, we're running a little bit out of time. So, let's go ahead and fix that real quick. All right. So the Access Control Service 2.0 recently went into production. And what this means is we now have full support for the ability to leverage multiple identity providers within your application. So you can do things such as leveraging LiveID, Yahoo, Google, and even Active Directory. Active Directory support here is fabulous. You can certainly use something like Windows Identity Foundation today to tap into ADFS or your Active Directory Federation server, but having access control also able to mediate it means that you can not only build your application to target Active Directory, but you can also include other types of users as well. And through the rules that you can define within the access control service, you can create a different experiences based on the identity provider someone authenticated against. So if a user comes in and authenticates against Active Directory, you could give them more access to resources in your application than a user that authenticated with Google or Yahoo or LiveID. So it gives you a lot of granular control over the application. And what's really nice about using Windows Identity Foundation with the Access Control Service means that it's a consistent and similar programming model for interacting with these identity resources. So nothing really changes. In fact, Vittorio Bertacci, who's one of my colleagues, is going to be talking about ACS and WIF, and he's written a fabulous book on Windows Identity Foundation that spends a little bit time talking about the version 1 release of ACS, but what's nice about it is that book is still 100% applicable to ACS 2.0 because of Windows Identity Foundation. So very, very important. What's also nice is for the management experience, it's using full REST API, so anything you do in the portal, you can also do programmatically for the access control service, which means that you don't necessarily have to manually create all these rules. You can programmatically create all of this stuff that define how you leverage access control service. And then also at the bottom it says it's going to be free of charge through January 1st of next year. And then once it is charged, it's actually really low cost. $2 for every 100,000 transactions. It's not very expensive. I'll come back to the demo if there's time in a moment. Man, this is what happens when you only have 2 minutes to prep for the talk. Size doesn't look right. Actually, it looks like it's the wrong format, too. All right. Windows Azure AppFabric caching. What's exciting about this is it's been in CTP since PDC last year, but by the end of this week, it's going to be a production service. So this is really awesome. The caching service is based on the Windows Server AppFabric caching application or service that's been around for over a year now. So we've shipped it as an on-premise distributed in-memory cache, and we've taken that code base, that platform, and made it a service so that you don't have to, you know, define a lot of instances and deploy Windows Server App Fabric caching into it and create your own cluster and so forth. All you need to do is say new service namespace, define a name, click create, and within 30 seconds you have your own distributed in-memory cache. The primary use case for the caching service is to support other applications you have running in Windows Azure. And the reason for this is a network-based caching service. So when you communicate to it, you are going across the network. Now imagine using the service on-premises, always having to call out to a data center that exists somewhere else in the world. The network latency is going to be pretty high. So what you want to do is co-locate your applications in the same data center as you have your cache service set up. So it's very, very easy to do to create that application near your cache. And when this goes into production, the caching service will be available in all 6 of the Windows Azure data centers. In terms of comparability with Windows Server App Fabric, the APIs are fully symmetric. So that means if you are building for the on-premises world, the code that you write is exactly the same as when targeting the Windows Azure App Fabric service as well. And we'll get to the demo if possible. Now, a couple of the other building block services that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about thus far are some of these additional cloud data services. And the very first one is SQL Azure Reporting. Now, the SQL Azure Reporting service is another one of these services that first existed as a server product. So we ship today SQL Server Reporting Services. And what we've done is we've taken that and, again, made it available as a service. So in terms of using SQL Azure Reporting, you use the same tools. So you still use BIDS, which is the Business Intelligence Design Studio, which is part of the Visual Studio IDE. You still use that to author and create your reports, and you also can use it to deploy these reports to SQL Azure. Once they're deployed to SQL Azure, then you can author your web application to use these reports, deploy your application to Windows Azure, and now you get the benefit of SQL Azure Reporting in your application deployed in the cloud. So very cool service that is today available as part of a CTP. We also have the SQL Azure Data Sync tool. SQL Azure Data Sync allows you to synchronize databases not only in SQL Azure, so I can deploy a database to, let's say, the North Central Windows Azure Data Center and deploy it to SQL Azure, and I can deploy my SQL Azure database to a data center in Europe and even to Asia, and then I can use SQL Azure Data Sync to keep them all synchronized. So it's not just one-way synchronization, it's bi-directional synchronization, and it leverages under the covers the SQL Sync framework, which is extensible and you can tap into and... Oh, I advanced. I'm sorry. And so you can use SQL Azure to synchronize this data. What's nice is you can also synchronize this data between SQL Azure and SQL Server. So if you want to keep the master data available in SQL Server and maybe move some read-only data into SQL Azure or whatever your use case may be, you can use SQL Azure Data Sync to synchronize these databases both in the cloud and on-premises. And then the last is the Windows Azure Data Market. And the Windows Azure Data Market is really nothing more than a marketplace for data. And there's 2 different pivots to it. So we as developers can leverage large data sets that are part of the Windows Azure Data Market within our applications. So these could be, one of the things that I think is pretty cool is there's a ton of sports data up there. So whether it's baseball or American football or other sports, years of data are available in the data market that you can purchase and then use within your applications. So that's the developer pivot. There's also a pivot of I'm an enterprise and I have a lot of data and I want to monetize that data. And you can take your data and put it available in the Windows Azure Data Market and leverage the data market as a way to capitalize and monetize the data that you have. And so there's 2 different ways to use the Windows Azure Data Market, which I think are pretty neat. And it is available as a commercial service today. So if you go to the windowsazure.com and select the Data Market tab, you can learn more about how getting it set up. Now, one thing that I haven't talked about yet, but I think is a pretty interesting service that we deployed recently, helps to confront the problems of performance, and in particular, network latency. And the case here that I want to make is, let's say I deploy my web application into the U.S. Central North data center. Well, if I'm anywhere, you know, near that data center somewhere in North America, that latency is low enough that, you know, the performance is great. But as I start to creep a little bit further and further away, the latency gets bigger and bigger. And really, once you move off the continent, it's going to be a pretty slow data access. Now, the thing that we can do is really use a service that does some smart DNS magic, if you will, to route the user to a data center closest to them. So instead of just having my application running in the U.S. North data center and forcing all the users to traverse the Atlantic or the Pacific to get to it, I'll deploy my application in a data center on each continent, and then I'll use something called the Global Traffic Manager to intelligently route users to that data center. So let me go ahead and talk about this. So what the Global Traffic Manager does is it provides the ability to load balance across data centers. And this is important for a number of scenarios. The first is performance. I don't want to have my users have to traverse, you know, a great distance in order to get to my application. I want them to go to the closest data center that's possible. And so I can define a policy within the Traffic Manager that says, hey, look up, you know where the user is originating them from, direct them to the closest data center. This is also good for fault tolerance. We know that data centers can have issues, that they can go down occasionally, and instead of not having access to the resources in that data center, you can define a fault tolerance policy that says when the data center is not available, route the traffic for a period of time to a different data center. That way I can deploy my application in multiple data centers, and if anything should happen, you know, whether it be DNS issues or networking or, you know, an asteroid hits the data center, traffic will be routed to a different data center for a period of time based on the policies defined in the Traffic Manager. And then another way you can configure it is for what we call round robin. And this allows us to define fixed ratios. Now, I think the use case here that's particularly interesting is the ability to add new features to our application. So let's say I've got a great idea, I want to add this new capability to my application, but I am worried that either it's going to confuse users or they may not like it, and I don't want to necessarily switch it and make everyone have to start using it. Well, I could define a fixed ratio here that says take 95% of the users that come to my application and continue to route them to my existing production service. That way, nothing changes for them, and the vast majority of my users never experience anything different. But for 5% of the users, route them to a different set of compute instances that I have running where I deploy my updates, my new features. And that way, I can use a small segment of my user base to test out, to take a look at, and get some feedback on what they think of the application. So it's an interesting way to maybe roll out some enhancements. All this, again, is managed through the portal. It's kind of hard to see, I apologize. But essentially, when you go into the Windows Azure portal, you can effectively create these policies. It requires no code. In fact, I would imagine in most cases, you'd have someone on your IT pro staff responsible for managing these policies. So it's a pretty neat service that's available. Now, I'm out of time, so I'm going to try to wrap up here a little bit. But I want to talk real quick about some of the ways in which you can get started. On the left, you'll see the Windows Azure Pass. The Windows Azure Pass is a great way to get quickly started because you can do it very quickly and you don't need to put a credit card in. So one of the challenges we've had, I think, in the past is people aren't quite sure how much it's going to cost, and so they've not been willing to use that credit card to try out the platform. So using the Windows Azure Pass, you can get free 30-day access to all these resources without having to use a credit card. So it's a great way to try it out. Just go to windowsazurepass.com. You can use, there's a whole bunch of different promo codes. I've listed out one here called CloudCover, which is a show that myself and Steve Marks have on Channel 9. And you can use this to get free 30-day access. So it's a great way to try it out. On the right side is something a little bit more formal. It's called the introductory trial. It's also free, but you do need to sign up for an account, which means you also will use a credit card. The reason I think this is still interesting and compelling is once you've signed up, you'll get free trial through September 30th, but when you're ready to take it to production, you don't need to create another account or do anything. You can transition this introductory trial account directly into a full production account. Also, how many of you here have some kind of MSDN benefit, whether it's Ultimate Premium or Professional? And keep your hands up. All right, how many of you knew that through MSDN you got free access to Windows Azure? Keep your hands up. Okay, good. Well, most of you seem to know that. Well, good. Well, what we've done is we've upgraded these benefits. So basically, if you want to make it simple, if you have Ultimate or Premium, your usage is doubled. So you get twice the amount of compute hours, you get more storage, more transactions, more bandwidth, and a larger database. What we have added that's new is support for Professional or MSDN Professional. Before, we didn't provide free resources. Now, if you have a Professional MSDN account, you can get 750 free extra small instance hours, which really 750 hours equates to running one service 24/7 for a whole month. So use it. You can use it intelligently and get a little bit more out of it, but effectively it gives you the way to run an application 24/7 if you want to. Here's some resources. I'm going to go ahead and leave this up since I want to go ahead and wrap. But there's a lot of great resources here. Our team produces the Windows Azure Platform Training Kit, which, man, the training kit now is over 200 megabytes, so sorry for the large download size. But there's a lot of great resources in there, hands-on labs, demos, presentations, you name it. We've also released a bunch of accelerators and toolkits. There's an accelerator for Embraco, so if you want to use the Embraco CMS, we've got an accelerator that's really neat, makes it very easy to deploy updates, manages all the updates. Since it's a CMS, it means that you're not only writing back to a database, you're also updating files local to that instance. So this accelerator allows you to update files in an instance, and then it synchronizes it with other instances that are running your Embraco application. So very cool accelerator there. If you're doing any kind of Windows Phone 7 development, we've got a toolkit that makes it very simple and easy. I had wanted to have time to show you, but don't have time. And then finally, a BidNow sample is a great reference application that uses just about every service we make available in Windows Azure and gives you a good idea as to different ways to leverage and use it. So a lot of different resources. And with that, thank you guys very much. I know we plowed through a lot of stuff. Apologies about the compressed time schedule here, but if you have any questions, feel free to come and ask. If not, hopefully lunch is ready. So thank you very much.